Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is deal-making so often an unpredictable, if not chaotic, act, and how can we benefit from embracing the uncertainty? As we head into negotiations, some of us plan to maintain an unyielding position to get what we want, while others imagine a win-win solution. But as my guest today will tell us, the problem with those approaches is that they assume we can predict what will happen and prepare ourselves accordingly, when in fact negotiation is dynamic by nature and demands ongoing learning, adaptation, and influencing. Michael Wheeler is a professor at Harvard Business School and editor of the Negotiation Journal. His new book is The Art of Negotiation: How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. He joins us today from the studios at Harvard University. Michael, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me on, Chris.
So most of us understand that it is imperative to go into a negotiation well prepared. Why is it also important to assume there are things that we cannot know?
Well, it's just the nature of the beast. It's not one hand clapping. It's trying to shake the hand of the person who's crossed the table. And they're likely to be as well prepared as you are, maybe as smart as you are, and perhaps as unpredictable as you are. We can't script their lines. We can't tell them what to say or do any more than we'd let them write our script.
So do we need to learn as much as we can about them and not allow them to learn very much at all about us?
I would say no. I mean, obviously, we want to have a sense of who they are and who they might be. But even with people that we've dealt with for some time, Chris, we all have good days or bad days. Or it may be that if we're selling something to a longtime customer, that he or she is under budget constraints that didn't exist before. Or for that matter, they may be in desperate need for our goods or services. So we have a general sense of how things have been, but I think we have to be open to the fact that they may be better or worse this time around.
So you say that effective negotiation typically involves pretty rapid cycles of learning, adapting, and influencing. First of all, how is that learning different from what we might imagine it to be?
Well, learning as we usually think about it, whether it is learning a new language or learning to play the piano or whatever, the piano has 88 keys, whether we're fast learners or slow learners. But when we're learning how to engage another person constructively, they're responding to what we do. And whether it's that they graciously accept a carrot that we offer or they throw it back at us, it's a changing environment. So I once said to a student of mine, you know, it's not like climbing a mountain. The mountain is still the mountain, whether we climb it or not. But he actually had some climbing experience. And he said, you know, the mountain changes all the time. It can get cold when you're at higher altitudes. Bad weather can come in, and you may find that you've gotten exhausted in the process. So even that is a dynamic process. It's all the more so in negotiation.
And sometimes success goes from getting to the top of that mountain to getting back down alive.
That's true. And if we're to stay within that metaphor, one of the outdoor leadership schools, the founder has this great saying, summit isn't the only place on the mountain. Some people strive for achievements or deals that just aren't in the cards, but they might get to a very good place if they recognized what the obstacles were and found another destination.
So, Michael, what kind of relationship do we need to have to our goals in any negotiation? We walk in sort of knowing exactly what we want, but then we might realize in the course of talking to someone else on the other side of the table that we want something a little bit different.
I would dial that back a little bit, Chris. I think that we ought to know generally what our preferences and trade-offs are. So somebody negotiating for a job, obviously, you know, more salary is better than less salary. More benefits is better than less in the way of benefits. And having more responsibilities and resources, that's all good. But if you think about that bundle of issues that you're going to negotiate, you should have some idea of how much of one thing you might give up in order to secure even more of another. You don't want to be doing that on the fly. You want to think those things through. But until you know where the other side is coming from, it might be easier for them to pay you in one currency as opposed to another. So I would say be cautious about going in with a very specific goal, but do be careful to understand what your priorities and trade-offs are.
Okay, so let's step back for a moment here and talk about the sort of old school recommendations for negotiators. First, there was the notion that the very best negotiators are the ones that sort of drive a hard bargain and refuse to compromise.
Well, some of that is true. It depends on the context and whom you're negotiating with. Though, as we've already said, part of that is something that you discover as you negotiate. I remember hearing a story. There was a conference at the University of Las Vegas on negotiation and gambling. And one of the participants told about a developer, a casino developer, who shows up in Mississippi when they legalized gambling and was interested in buying a piece of property the family had owned for something like eight generations, going back into the early 1800s. Well, the family thought about, you know, what to ask for. And one of the more aggressive siblings said, let's ask for $5 million. And other siblings thought that might be a little too much, but ultimately went along with him. They have the meeting with the developer. The developer goes through the pleasantries and says, now listen, the most we can offer you is $20 million, four times what they thought they were going to ask for. Mm-hmm. Of course, they immediately caucused and took a deep breath and came back, and they settled for 25. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a classic kind of bargaining situation, and they were prepared to put a number on the table, but it turned out that their number was actually too modest. So there can be a haggling aspect of it. There can be the advice about never make offer. We can talk about that a little bit. And there are times that pays off. But that wasn't a negotiation where there were long-term relationships that had to be maintained. There wasn't a lot of innovation that was possible. So that was a more classic, more for you is less for me kind of situation.
What about that old advice about never making the first offer? What's the thinking behind that, and does it still hold?
Well, I guess the case that I just described would be a classic example of that,
right.
where it turns out that the other side wants what you have much more than you had anticipated. But I guess I would test any advice by asking this question. If it's smart for you to follow that prescription, then it's smart for the other side. So each person stares at the other, waiting for the other to say something, and they're like the sphinxes on the deserts of Egypt. Nobody gives away too much, but a deal doesn't get made. And more fundamentally, if I'm too cute, if I'm too cozy, if I'm not willing to engage you, I'm basically anchoring the conversation that this is going to be a hardball, long, drawn-out kind of negotiation, and it's inviting you to engage in the same kind of behavior.
Hmm. You describe a lot of negotiations as more like a conversation than something else, like maybe more like a conversation than like a fight.
Well, I think it certainly can be that. And that's even true when what is being discussed is a dispute, whether mm-hmm. it's resolution of a lawsuit or a work stoppage, be it a strike or a lockout. At the heart of it, even in those cases, there may be some opportunity for mutual gain. It won't be realized if people don't share some sense of what their relative priorities are.
So to the extent that you advise people to listen to the other party in negotiations, I mean, everyone goes, well, of course I'm listening. But is there a different kind of listening required here?
I think there is. And I'm very glad you asked that question. We've all heard of active listening. And I guess I'd say, you know, not three cheers, not even two cheers, but one cheer for that. But that's the kind of thing where I say something and then, Chris, you say, okay, if I heard you correctly, and you basically replay it. Supposedly that acknowledges what the other person has said. It supposedly shows some degree of respect. Unless it's done well, though, that sounds very formulaic. Hmm. I think what's required and is difficult is real deep listening. So you mentioned conversations earlier. If we're distracted, if we meet somebody at a cocktail party, you know, we may forget their name within 15 seconds because our mind is elsewhere. We're thinking about what they make of us. We're thinking about whether the person on the other side of the room might be more interesting to talk to. We're thinking about whether the person we're talking to is looking over our shoulder for the same reason. all of that chatter gets in the way of real deep listening and understanding. And if we're able to turn that chatter off and attend to what the other person is truly saying, when they're done speaking, we'll know what to say. If we try to script it, we haven't heard them out. And whatever we've said that's in response to their first comment is irrelevant by the time they get to their third or fourth one.
So for you, the first step of negotiation, Michael, is not sitting down at the table. It's not plotting strategy. It's not even doing research. It's deciding whether we want to eventually get to that table in the first place.
Well, that's right. I think that's a threshold question. And many times the answer is yes, but I don't want to take that as a given. There are certain instances where if somebody has asked you to do something or has made a generous offer, our answer simply ought to be yes. You know, thank you very much. I tell the story in the book about a colleague of mine. I changed his name to spare him embarrassment. He was generous enough to share the story with me. Very successful guy, and he was teaching in a area where he had the advantage of living near the water and a nice oceanfront home. And he got to know a couple that lived down the beach. And they were childless. They were getting along in years. And they had never paid any taxes, Chris, on their property. They had never gotten a tax bill. But after 20 years, they got a tax bill.
Oh, goodness.
It was huge. It was all the back taxes plus interest. So they approached my friend and said, "We think of you as a son. We'd like to sell you this this property. We'll give you a very reasonable price, $2.5 million. Now, I don't have $2.5 million sitting in my pocket at present. Maybe
nor
you do,
I.
Chris. I'm not sure. And if your listeners do, we hope they share some of them with your station. But back to this story, my friend didn't have that kind of walking around money, and he approached a guy who was on the Fortune 500 list and said, "Could we go in on this together? Because the house is clearly worth more, and when I decide to move, we could split the upside, the profit." His friend said, "Fine, but they're asked 2.5. Let's counteroffer at 2.25. My friend was a little nervous about that, said, "Gee, this is a personal kind of thing." And the investor said, "But it's always negotiable." So with some reluctance, my friend drew up a purchase and sale agreement. He's a lawyer, presented it, and they read through all of this fine print the owners do, and they get to the end. It says 2.25 as opposed to 2.5 million. They say, "What's this?" And rather sheepishly, my friend said, "Well, it's the counteroffer." Long silence. They said, "Counteroffer? We regard you as a friend, and you counteroffer with us? Let's forget this." So they put their property on the market and sold it for $11 million. So that's a case where my friend obviously is kicking himself four ways to Sunday that he even tried to negotiate. There might have been other ways in which that could have been handled, but that deserved a handshake or in this case maybe a hug and a thank you very much.
Michael Wheeler is my guest. He's professor at Harvard Business School and editor of the Negotiation Journal. We're discussing his new book, The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, sending a tweet to @ChrisBoydThink, or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Wheeler, professor at Harvard Business School and editor of the Negotiation Journal. His new book is called The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. If you've got a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So any successful negotiation is going to operate with a certain set of parameters. Can you tell us about a deal triangle and how it works?
Well, what we're thinking about is there is a bottom line that you have. It may be more of a watercolor brushstroke than a fine architect's line, but there's a certain minimum set of requirements that must be good enough that you'll say yes to. Otherwise, whether it's a house you're going to buy or a car you might buy or a job you might take, otherwise you'll go elsewhere. But the other party also has his or her own constraints, and those bound the possible outcomes as well. And finally, we have to take into account legal and practical constraints as well. So if you take those as three sides of a triangle, they basically contain the set of deals that are feasible. You might like something a whole lot, but if it's not in the cards as far as acceptability with the other party, or if it raises some legal problems of one kind or another, you can dream about it, but you can't get it.
We always have to be, you know, have our eyes on the finish line. How do we do that and remain flexible and open to potential new solutions that might present themselves?
Well, a lot of what appears in my book comes from what I've learned from great negotiators. Here up at Harvard, we have something called the Program of Negotiation that's a collaboration not just with Harvard schools but also MIT, Tufts, and some other area schools. And we give an annual prize to great negotiators. The most recent one, in fact, was a Texan, Jim Baker, former Secretary of State in the first Bush administration for his work in helping reunify Germany. And when will those people come in, we do much more than just give them a plaque. They spend a day with us. We have seminars. We prepare very carefully for them. And I remember earlier, before Secretary Baker got his award, we gave the award to the late Richard Holbrooke, who negotiated the Dayton Accords resolving the conflict in former Yugoslavia. And he said, and it's been echoed by others as well, that negotiation is really like jazz. It's not linear. You know where you want to go, but it's improvising on a theme. You've got to find a path that will take you to what your ultimate goal is, but it may not be the path you anticipated.
What's interesting about that is that, you know, again, if we're going to extend this metaphor, jazz musicians are paying close attention to one another, not necessarily trying to overshadow one another. Everyone understands going in that there's going to be a give and take.
Well, it's interesting that, and that's the ethic in that venue. I'm not a musician myself, Chris, but I've learned a lot from a colleague who teaches organizational behavior at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. He's also an accomplished jazz musician. Frank Barrett is his name. And he has a terrific book out called Yes to the Mess. And what he means by that is an attitude where you basically play the hand that's been dealt. It may not be the cards that you want, but you make the best of it. And jazz musicians do the same thing. So I've learned a lot from Frank and from jazz musicians. I've had the privilege of being able to talk to Wynton Marsalis, who, in addition to being a gifted musician, is also very insightful and very generous with what he knows about life as well as about music. So there's a lot of that in my book.
How important is it to hang on to our ability to walk out if it becomes clear that nothing is going to go the way we want it to?
Well, I think that that's right. I remember doing some consulting work for a successful firm, a mid-sized firm, and I was meeting with the CEO and, in this case, his senior managers. And he said with evident pride, he said, you know, we never fail to come to agreement. We always are able to work something out. And because we were in company with some of his senior people, I didn't say anything. But when I met with him privately, I said, that's an odd thing to be proud about, that you always come to agreement. I said, there are two explanations, and both of them are troublesome. One is that you're being too agreeable, that you're saying yes for the sake of saying yes, when the deal really isn't in your interest. Second possibility is you're being ultra cautious. There might be some things which you would attempt. You're not confident you would make a deal, but if you could, it would be a triumph. Those should be in your portfolio as well. So you can have a great batting average if you're not facing very good pitching, you know, if you're not competing in the big leagues. So I encouraged him to allow his negotiators to come back empty-handed. They may have been creative. They may have been patient. But it's possible the deal wasn't there. They shouldn't be punished for circumstances that are beyond their control.
So I saw a friend's Facebook post this morning that said, I did it. I got a new car. It took me 5 hours in the dealership to come to a deal. And I was thinking about your book, Michael, and I was thinking about the fact that, you know, there are people who do this every day or they do it regularly through their work. And there are a lot of us who rarely have to negotiate. And when we do, we come up against people who do it all the time. What do we do in those situations?
Well, first thing, I wonder if you really kept a diary, Chris. My hunch is that you're negotiating more than you think. It may not be I'll trade you this for that, but you're working something out.
With my children, yes.
Well, in that case, we have two wonderful grown daughters, but sometimes I say you just ought to get a white flag in that case.
Yeah.
But yes, you are negotiating with them on two levels. I mean, let's stay with your children example. There are certain things you want them to do, whether it's to get their homework done before the TV goes on. But you're also trying to teach them how to be responsible individuals. And there are certain things that need doing without a great deal of discussion. There are other things that need doing after there's been discussion. So you're negotiating the micro transaction about whether they're going to help doing the dishes tonight. But in a macro way, you're also teaching them how to be responsible with other people.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do, though, if we feel outmatched and we recognize, is it just about collecting as much information as possible and going in armed with that and really keeping an eye on our ability to walk out the front door if we need to?
Well, I think that that's true, but I think you can do more than that, Chris. It's not fair, but even in this day and age, you may be able to rebuild a transmission in a car, whereas I don't know, the front from the back. But typically, with exception, but typically I'll be quoted a lower price than you are because, you know, I'm an older white male and you're not.
Mm-hmm.
If you carry a copy of Consumer Reports or some other kind of automotive magazine, research shows you will be quoted a lower price. And the reason for that is that when the salesperson sees you, he or she is sizing you up, trying to figure out how informed you are, what your willingness to pay is. You may like to dress nicely. I'm not entirely sure that you want to look as if you've got a big bank account when you go shopping for a car.
Right. So what can we learn from looking back on negotiations that maybe didn't go our way or didn't end up resolved the way we might have hoped going in?
Well, it's interesting. In the book, in addition to drawing on jazz, I draw from military strategy. And there's a very strong ethic in the various services of doing what they call after-action reviews, trying to determine what they did right, what they could do differently, where luck may have come into play. So I think if you went to a little more effort and kept a negotiation diary, where in your first entry you'd say, here are my goals, here's what's important to me, here's how I plan to approach this. And when it's over, whether, as you say, you reached a deal or not, you would ask two questions. One is, what worked well, and what would you do differently? Now, I know we all lead busy lives, but you wouldn't have to improve your negotiation performance a great deal for that to be a very worthwhile exercise.
Is there a particular point in negotiations at which they are at their most vulnerable?
I think it's actually at the beginning, Chris. You know, there can be blow-ups at the very end. I tell the story of the book about real estate closings, and there was a real estate closing where a woman flung a set of keys at somebody else at the table. It actually caused him to bleed profusely, and the somebody else was her husband. She was mad at him for selling for what she felt was too low a price. So things could be hard from beginning to end, and they could be hard on your own team. But I think the openings are terribly important because they set the tone for what follows. It's possible to get off to a bad start and recover. It's possible to start very well and to run out of endorphins or blood sugar or whatever. But past is usually prologue. So I think special effort needs to be attended to in terms of getting off to a strong and constructive start.
Okay, so let's talk about the role of emotion, because it's not necessarily a bad thing in negotiation. It can help us really pinpoint what actually matters to us. But clearly, it is something that we need to keep under control.
I think so. And it's interesting that those of us in the negotiation field have been slow to address this topic. I think that that's changed in the last several years, but Daniel Goleman's books on emotional intelligence are what, you know, they go back at least 15 years now. So in leadership and management generally, it's been written about that intelligence isn't merely the ability to do cube roots or things of that sort, but also the ability, one, to recognize your own emotions, two, to understand what is driving them, three, to see how they are affecting your behavior, and four, to be attendant to what other people may be experiencing emotionally. That started to come into our field. I hope I've addressed it in The Art of Negotiation, but we've been a little bit late to the party, and I'm so glad that you said it's not all negative. A lot of negotiations about relationship building, and as a consequence, we have to have empathy, and people that we're dealing with have to recognize that.
We have an email here from Karen in Fort Worth who wants to know, I knew we would get to this, what it would take for you to go to Washington, D.C. and teach both sides of Congress to talk and resolve their differences.
Well, I've been asked that question, as a lot of people in my field, and I do want to avoid being a Monday morning quarterback here. Not everything is negotiable. We'll see some years from now, behind the scenes, what kind of messages might have been passed back and forth, and whether there was some sort of deal that could be salvaged. It is possible, though, I say to your writer and to you, Chris, that this was non-negotiable. It was cast in those terms. It was as if the parties strategically painted themselves into corners because in President Obama's case, he felt that there'd be a bad precedent set if enacted laws were modified in view of a withholding of spending of the debt ceiling. And people on the other side might have felt that it's better to fight this down the wire and make the case for it. There'll be other battles coming down the road. The difficulty, of course, is there's been a lot of collateral damage in the process.
Well, the other interesting thing about that story, and I think about Speaker Boehner here, it's perhaps easier, maybe you would disagree with this, to negotiate when you're representing yourself and only yourself. It can be much more complicated when you have a position and you might see a way to go, but you represent a larger group of people that are going to hold you accountable for the decision that you make and the deal that you strike.
Oh, I think that's right. And there are actually analogies in everyday life. If you go to buy something from a vendor, if you're selling something to a customer, that person is in an organization and their performance is reviewed. They may want to help you, but their hands may be tied. When you ask kind of what might have happened differently in the most recent shutdown, I wonder whether we've got to go back further in time. If you recall, in 2011, Speaker Boehner and President Obama apparently were very close to a grand bargain, it was called, something that wasn't just going to be about health care, but about spending generally and about revenue, meaning taxes, on the other hand. And I wonder if one or both of them, if there were a time capsule, would go back to that point in July a couple of years ago and say, if we tweaked this or gave a little more of this, took a little less of that, whether a deal could have been reached not 2 weeks ago or a month ago, but maybe a couple of years ago.
We have an email here from Antonio that asks, is negotiating something that varies from culture to culture or country to country?
The answer is yes, in terms of the details. Mm-hmm. And I'll give an example. You might have two people who are both determined to have their own way, or at least not to compromise in such a way that it undermines their interests. In one culture, it may be perfectly all right to be direct, maybe even strident. Mm-hmm. In another, everybody's very polite. They nod yes, but they mean no. So it's the underlying motivation, I think, is the same from culture to culture. The way in which people are permitted to express themselves varies greatly. And I might add, you don't have to cross boundaries. You don't have to go through customs to see that. And I'm not just speaking about Texas versus Massachusetts. I'm talking about corporate culture. There are some go-getter kinds of corporations where they bargain very hard. There are some that are more collaborative. And we certainly know if somebody were to write a book, How Do You Negotiate with Americans? We come in lots of shapes, styles, and temperaments.
Michael Wheeler is my guest. He is professor at the Harvard Business School and editor of the Negotiation Journal. His new book is called The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses. smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Harvard Business School professor Michael Wheeler, who's just written a book called The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. He's speaking to us today, from the studios of Harvard University. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. So, Michael, recognizing that we will likely have to improvise once we get down to negotiating, and that there may be multiple elements to any deal that we strike, what does it take for our own purposes to sort of prioritize our goals? So if we go back to the job offer question, how do we decide what matters more? Is it salary? Is it vacation? Is it job title? That sort of thing.
Well, it's interesting. I think part of that is going to be a person's own taste, temperament, how much risk they're willing to take if they'd have to sacrifice some salary for equity in a company. Some of it's circumstantial, though. If it turned out that you had just bought a new place and you thought you had sold your old one and that deal fell through, so you suddenly owned two properties as opposed to one, then straight salary might look better than having some equity, even though you have confidence that the company is going to do better. So I don't think there's a right answer there. What's interesting to me is, and maybe it's just human nature, people are reluctant to think about hard choices in advance. And yet that's the time you want to do it. You want to think about, okay, I don't want to do it, but I'd be willing to take less salary here in view of getting X, Y, and Z. Well, how much X, how much Y, how much Z? Now, in the course of negotiation, you can always tweak those figures, but I want to start with something. There's a great jazz musician who says you can't improvise off nothing. And you don't want to be locked in. You want to use pencil, not pen, in terms of stating your preferences. But I would rather, when things aren't flying fast and furious, to think through those questions hard. You know, if you had to make a hard choice between two things you like, which would it be?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next on the phone with Joel in Fort Worth. Hi, Joel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And a great show and a great subject, really interesting to me. I work for a government agency, and my job, part of it, is to negotiate consultant contracts. And I tell you, that's one of the more nerve-wracking parts of the job, I guess, because you want to feel like you're getting the best for the taxpayers' dollar. But the question really is negotiating in the absence of a baseline. Like you just said, you got to go by something. If you're buying a house, you have comparable houses in the area, a car, same thing. But in consulting fees, there really isn't a baseline when you're looking at a scope and fee. You're basically building it for each project from scratch. And I just wonder what your thoughts and advice might be there. I'm definitely going to look into the book. So if you have something in there, please tell me.
Thanks for your call, Joel.
Thank you, too, Joel. I'd actually like to speak to both of your points. One is, if you will, the technical point about figuring out what your baseline is. And the second point, though, is you talk about being nerve-wracking. I want to get back to that because you're not alone. A lot of people get anxious about negotiation, and I'm afraid there can be a price we paid for it. Good news is there are ways of dealing with that, too. On the baseline question, I would say in any negotiation, Joel, you have to ask that as compared to what? So you may have a favored consultant. You may have somebody who believe that can deliver very good services. But if they weren't available, if they were hit by the proverbial bus, I assume that there's somebody else that you'd look to and for. And it seems to me you are shopping in the same way that anybody shops. It may be that this is the person you want is the higher price, and you can justify the value for it. But there's a certain point, no matter how good he or she is, that they're out of line with what you can get elsewhere. Maybe not quite as good, but at a much better price. If Joel's still on the line, I'll just be curious about whether this is just sole source or whether he does have the advantage of being able to look at several different consultants.
Typically it's one consultant to begin with. In the state of Texas, there's laws about hiring consultants where we have to select based on qualifications, then negotiate a fee after the consultant is selected.
But I would ask in that case, if the consultant isn't reasonable, if your sense from prior transactions on similar, not identical, but similar jobs, that you could do better with somebody else, I assume you can walk away. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's true. We can walk away. And it's interesting you mentioned that because as I was listening to the show earlier, I thought there was an acquaintance in the same agency that said, I've been doing this for 20 years and never had a consultant walk away from negotiation. I thought, well, you're probably not pushing it hard enough then.
And I think that's right. And I think that you want to feel okay, and you need to, in terms of your colleagues and who you report to, have them say, Joel, good job. I know you tried to get, name the best baseball player. I realize the Rangers aren't in it anymore. Our Red Sox are, but so be that. Sometimes it makes sense to get somebody at a good price. What you don't want to be is in a situation on Friday afternoon where you need somebody on Monday and they know it, because at that point you're going to obviously pay a tax on it. Can I turn to the other question, though, Chris, about it being nerve-wracking?
Sure.
I can say with some confidence that even experienced negotiators feel some degree of anxiety about the negotiation process. And with my very able colleague, Kim Leary, who's a psychologist, we've studied what that's about. And what it comes down to is exactly what Joel is describing. it's a system where there's very poor feedback. If you're shooting hoops, Joel, you know, the ball goes in or it doesn't. If it goes in, keep on doing what you're doing. If it doesn't, a little more arch, a little more bend in the knees. In negotiation, it's hard to know when you reach the deal whether you could have pushed a little harder. The only way to know that you've pushed too hard is when you blow up the deal. So on the interstate, you can go 65, you can go 68, maybe 72, but you better start looking for blue lights when you go much faster than that. So when you make a deal, you always wonder, how much more could I have gotten? And the other side isn't going to let you know that they would have settled cheaper. I think it's that uncertainty, even after a negotiation, Chris, that makes people nervous about their own performance.
So how do we know when to say yes?
What's that old saying? You know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. If there's something that you regard more than meets your requirements, that the other side has enough stake in that they're really going to deliver on what they promised, I think you get to a point where you say yes to that deal and move on to next. When you were talking about somebody else who'd written about spending 5 hours shopping for a car, if she saved herself several thousand dollars, that's a pretty good hourly rate. Hmm. You know, if it knocked $50 off it, then, you know, we're getting close to the minimum wage. So there are some deals you have to make, and maybe yes gets said earlier than that. There are also deals where if you don't work something out with this car dealer, there's another place a mile down the road. You can always try there.
This is an interesting idea, too, that if the other side says, no, can't do it, it's worth asking, okay, well, why? Which is something mm-hmm. that people might not immediately think to do.
That's right. And there are times that we're the ones who say, no, I can't do it. But you might add to the no, I can't do it at that price. But, you know, if you could do this, or if you could pay me in advance, or if we could couple this with another contract. So you've said no to a specific thing because it is not satisfactory, or you think you can do better. But you've also built them a bridge to some other kind of arrangement that might work for the both of you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Craig is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think you can break this down into two questions, but it might just be one. Is there a difference between how a 20 to 30-year-old today might negotiate versus, let's say, a 50 to 60-year-old today? And as I was thinking about it, a perfect example would be like if you take in the real estate business, you've got a real estate agent that is like in their 20s or 30s negotiating with a real estate agent that's maybe 50 to 60. Do you see any differences in the way the younger generations are negotiating versus maybe an older generation?
I don't see it, Craig. I know the research literature pretty well, and it may betray my ignorance. I don't know that anybody who's studied age effects that way. But it does strike me that there'd be two likely differences. One is we hope that we learn things with experience, not just in terms of being a better negotiator, but you have a better feel for the market. You have some sense of where it's going. You can look at a property, and yes, there's been a formal assessment, but you know whether to trust it or not. So you have substantive knowledge that you didn't have when you're 27 that you do have when you're 47 or 57. The other thing, though, is that there may be – we talked about cultural differences earlier. You know, we've got generational cultures as well. The 20-something person may not do email anymore. You know, I'm betraying my age when I say I'm still on email, but they're using other kinds of social media. They also, Craig, may be used to more transactional negotiation, offer counteroffer, where somebody older might be more given to a relational negotiation. Not to say that one is necessarily better than the other, but two people could be talking past each other because they have a different understanding of what negotiation entails.
Can these strategies that you recommend here and these principles that you discuss, can they work if you are negotiating with someone who is working with a really different style, approaching negotiation from a really different perspective?
Well, you described actually at the start of the show the cycle of learning, getting a better sense of whether there's room for agreement, learning in the sense of whom you're dealing with, influencing in the sense of trying to – it's in your interest that they behave constructively, but also adapting. There's a certain point where they may not have much bandwidth, and you're going to have to make the best of it. So I think all those things are happening simultaneously, and you're trying to refresh what you've learned so that you're in the present, not kind of worrying about what somebody said yesterday. It's obviously, there are two people on different sides of the table. And as we're influencing them, they're adapting to us. As they're influencing us, we're responding to what they're doing and saying. So it really is a dance.
What qualities would you say the best negotiators tend to have in common?
Well, I mentioned the Great Negotiator Prize that we've given to people in diplomacy and business, even in the arts. And as different as they are, and we're talking about people from the States and from beyond, they all seem to have a terrific presence of mind. When they are there engaged in the negotiation, they're not thinking of anything else. I think that they also have a certain kind of optimism that is grounded in reality. We gave an award to somebody that listeners may not have heard of, a guy named Lakhdar Brahimi, an Algerian troubleshooter who has dropped into the world's most dangerous trouble spots and sometimes been able to make peace. When students asked him what the most important quality was, Chris, he said you have to be two different things at once. You have to be arrogant and you have to be humble.
Hmm.
And people did say him to that. He said, now, by arrogant, I don't mean impolite, but you need to have the arrogance to believe that you can solve something that others can't, that others say it's non-negotiable, but you believe you might be able to affect change. On the other hand, you need to be humble. You need to understand that as well prepared as you are, at best, you'll only understand half the story. So you have to appreciate that others may have a different reality. And Brahimi was very impressive that way. And occasionally he is in Lebanon and other areas, he has stopped the killing. So he basically walks his talk.
Do you hate buying a car as much as everybody else?
No, I don't at all. I don't at all because there is somebody else down the street who will sell me the car if this person is being disagreeable. But I do get all the family business from that, Chris. If you write books about negotiation, if you teach it, then those chickens come home to roost, and that's where I earn my cred at home.
Michael Wheeler is a professor at Harvard Business School and editor of the Negotiation Journal. His new book is The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World, and he joined us today from the studios at Harvard University. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell prepares the podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.